Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, October 18th, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on the first and third Mondays of every month on the Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today you will hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include, can exercise all by itself work as well as medications to treat heart disease, prediabetes, and strokes?
Does wearing gowns and gloves in all ICU patients' rooms reduce the incidence of MRSA?
And why do doctors abuse prescription drugs? What leads them to that?
And can probiotics prevent and treat vaginal dryness?
That one's a stretch, huh? And what's in that chicken nugget that you eat? Do you really want to find out?
Yeah, you might not. We all know that exercise is healthy and medications can have some dangerous side effects. Just listen to the commercials on TV. And even deadly side effects, which is why the results of a new British study are so important. It turns out that exercise is just as effective in treating heart disease and diabetes as medications, and more effective than meds in treating strokes. So let's talk about this study.
Okay, this was published in October of 2013 in the British Medical Journal. It was done by the Britain London School of Economics and the Harvard and Stanford University Schools of Medicine. And what they found is there was no statistically detectable difference between exercise and drugs for patients who had coronary heart disease or prediabetes.
That's big.
That is amazing.
I mean, especially if somebody's able to exercise.
Well, yeah. Well, you can always do some kind of exercise, even if it's something that's done visually or mentally or inside. You know, they did some studies on people who had strokes years ago. And what they did is those that had paralysis on one side, they would tie the arm, the other arm behind the back, and they just do mental imagery of moving it. They also did some studies on athletes, which amazed me, where they were measuring athletes' strength when they were doing bicep jerks, where they pull weights up towards
curls.
Their chest. Curls, that's what they are. And what they found was those people who did mental imagery of curling and did it over a long period of time actually developed an increase in muscle strength.
Well, now, we need to be careful here because somebody might say, well, I'll just sleep in and lie in bed and imagine I'm doing that.
Now, these are people that, they were just doing an experiment.
Like maybe they'd had a stroke or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you tie one behind your back and you image doing the other one, the other arm actually builds strength and recovers quicker. So just the imagery of it happening has a powerful effect. So what they did is they looked at 305 studies that covered almost 340,000 patients, which is an amazing number of people, and found that exercise was more effective than drug treatment when it came to stroke. I mean, that's just an amazing thing. And it really shouldn't surprise us too much because I don't know of any medicine or of any treatment that's more effective as an anti-aging strategy than exercise.
Yeah, if we could put that on a pill, we'd make a lot of money.
Oh, that would be incredible. And here we are, as couch potatoes, a lot of us, not really paying attention to it.
Well, with cardiovascular disease, the number one killer in the world,
right. And
it kills 17 million per year, and physical inactivity is the fourth risk factor in global mortality.
Yeah, according to the World Health Organization, that's right.
Well, we really need to exercise more.
Well, yeah. I mean, in our particular case, we really are almost freaks, at least I am, exercising so much. Now that I'm a little older, I can't do it as well as I did before, and something always seems to hurt.
Especially since you broke your toes.
I broke my toes. I dropped like a lead ball on it. And anyway, I've had a history of being fit my whole life. And for my age, I'm still able to do things that most people can't because of it. So it's something that's really important to do.
Well, I figure you might as well use it or lose it.
That's the truth.
And use it while you can, because if you've ever noticed, especially when you get to be our age, but if you notice that if something happens and you can't exercise, say, for a week or two, the difference
it's
in
huge.
Your body, it just changes so quickly.
You know, I had a friend who was a Wimbledon tennis champion and actually played competitive tennis at the highest level in age groups up to about the age of 80. And he used to tell me, he says, it's easy to get back in shape if you miss a few months when you're in your 20s. It's a little harder in your 30s. It's ridiculous in your 60s, and it's impossible in your 80s. And he's really right. He was really right.
Yeah, it's that whole thing, use it or lose it, because it really is hard to get it back. And you can see the difference in your body and the toning of it and everything.
Well, the body's magical. It adapts to whatever stresses you put on it within limits. And the harder you exercise and the more often you do it, the more strength and power that you developed. When you do that kind of exercise.
A few months ago, I was sick. I had a really bad sinus infection. I just felt terrible, and I was in bed for a few days, and I obviously wasn't exercising, and I was just staying in bed, and I lost some weight. But, oh, my gosh, my body looked terrible. It didn't look good because I lost weight.
Well, how'd you feel when you started exercising?
Well, I just want to compare it. So lately, I've been trying to lose some weight, and I've been still exercising like I normally exercise, and I'm happy with how my body's looking. I'm not feeling like the skin is sagging and that kind of thing. And when
well,
I
you
wasn't,
look great.
But when I wasn't exercising, my skin was like kind of sagging, and now it's not.
It's
of course,
got more
when people
tone.
Are young, they don't worry about their skin sagging, but you know, it's just something that I observed the difference in being able to exercise while cutting back on calories as opposed to not.
It's a little tough cutting back on calories because you become weak and it's hard to exercise. You just don't have enough of that ATP, that
it's
energy
currency.
It's hard
to get your energy up.
It really is very hard to do that. But once you get it down, if you get into a regular routine, the body adapts to whatever
time,
you challenge
yeah,
it with.
With time, it gets better.
But what happens with age is that it takes less time to get out of shape and much longer to get back in shape. And
that's
it's like
it.
A logarithmic relationship, because as you approach 80 or 90, how many 80 or 90-year-olds you see who can even jog? I mean, they have enough trouble walking with their walkers if they don't really keep up with things.
Well, you know, there are other diseases that exercises can help to prevent. And they brought up a few of them in this article about colon and breast cancer, depression, osteoporosis, and obesity. We know that there are a lot more things than just that, but the type of exercise that they recommend, what type of exercise
well,
do they
see,
recommend?
All these studies do it different ways. And in this particular thing, they're saying that just moderate exercise with moderate intensity.
Regularly.
That's what they say, but I don't agree with them. I think that the more intense exercise you can do without getting hurt, that's the caveat, without getting hurt, the better your body will respond to it to be able to adapt.
Well, also, if you do it really hard, though, you might not be able to do it as long.
Well, that's why I say you have to do it and adapt to it.
Yeah, I think you have to listen to
your body.
Well,
there's this thing called interval training, Vicki, where you sprint, and you sprint for as long as you feel you can without running yourself, you know, into the ground. And maybe it's 10 yards, maybe it's 100 yards, maybe it's 250 yards, or even more, depending on your age and the condition you're in. And then you stop and walk, and you kind of recover.
Well, you can kind of time your day so that you can be a little late to catch the bus, and then you can run to catch it.
Well, that's one way to do it. Well, you can time how long it takes for your body to recover that heart rate that you had before you started. Say your heart rate was 70 before you started, and you got it up to 160 or 170, depending on what your age is, or maybe 120 if you're really older. How long does it take to come back down to 70? Now, I had one patient who in his 60s, this was about 25 years ago, who I was trying to do a stress test on without taking him down to the lab, and he was a real athlete. And so we did that, and he would go out and run up and down the stairs a couple of times and come back, and by the time I could put the blood pressure cuff on him, his heart rate had already come back down to his 70 starting point.
So he was in good shape.
He was in incredible shape. So there are a lot of things that we have to pay attention to when we're looking at exercise. And definitely, even a walk around the block or doing some light exercise for 10 or 15 minutes a day will do a lot more than if you're a couch potato and you don't get anything.
Well, you know, I don't know if you count stretching as exercise.
Mild
but
exercise.
But I think stretching is a really good thing for people, because I've noticed that if I don't stretch, I'm a lot stiffer and less limber than when I do stretch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're talking about something different. Flexibility is important, too.
Well, you need to be flexible if you're going to be doing these types of exercise because you don't want to get hurt.
Yeah, it's better if you do.
And you don't want to fall. You want your balance to be good.
Yeah, that's good.
You want to increase your muscle mass and all those things.
Yes.
And so
stretching,
it all works together.
Yes, it does. And so the stretching part gives you a range of motion that's a little bit better. But there's a downside to that, too, because if you overdo the exercise at the ends of the range of motion, that's when you find getting injuries is a real problem.
Yeah, well, you need to work into things.
Do something like Pilates, because Pilates is a great way to stretch out and build strength at the ends of range of motion.
And what about yoga? You know, I think people mm-hmm. need to also be careful with yoga.
For sure.
The type of person I am is that when somebody tells me to do a stretch, I feel like I really need to do that stretch or position or whatever it is the way they tell me to do, and it's very difficult for me to hold back on it even if I know better. You know, that's the thing, is that people need to be able to discipline themselves with exercises and stretches and any of that.
Well, that's really
because
right.
That's when you get an injury, and you can't be competitive like, oh well, everybody else is doing it. And
well, see, that's the story of the weekend warrior. It's not exactly the same thing, but that's the person who's in his 30s, 40s, or 50s, or whatever age they're in, and they want to get back in shape, and they think they're going to do it in a weekend, so they sign up for a marathon or an Ironman or something like that, which, of course, is just nuts.
Well, I saw you do that. I saw my father do that, too, and you both got hurt.
Well, that's what happens. You know, too much testosterone
ruined
drives
the whole
you to
vacation week.
Oh, I remember that. That was crazy, yeah. So it takes a certain amount of common sense.
But regular exercise is what's key to good health.
Well, it is. And the more you can do and the more intense it is without getting hurt, the more your body's going to adapt and give you reserves that are better.
So other things that exercise can help better than medications, I guess, would be
like so many
it helps with blood pressure. If you have high blood pressure, it will lower your blood pressure.
I don't know anything much more powerful, Vicki, than exercise to treat hypertension, because it does a lot of things. If you're depressed, it helps with that as well, and maybe that's related to your blood pressure rising. Or if you're anxious, it would help with that. And it certainly helps conditioning the body. And so blood pressure can have dramatic drops. I've seen people drop from 210 over 120 to blood pressures like 130 over 90 or 130 over 80. And if you exercise twice a day, because the effects of exercise probably only last 3 or 4 hours, that's pretty good.
So in other words, you'd have to talk to your doctor about it, but instead of taking the pill, how often do you take a blood pressure pill? Twice a day?
Once or twice or three times or four times.
So maybe instead of exercising an hour all at once, do a half an hour twice a day or something like that.
Well, see, what I tell my patients, and you'll probably like this, is that I don't want them to take any blood pressure pills without first taking their blood pressure, because they should know what it is.
Yeah.
What happens if your blood pressure drops because you've exercised and you're relaxed or maybe had a drink and it drops to 110 over 70? And then you take a blood pressure pill or two and it drops to 90 or 80 over 60.
And then you get up and you pass out.
You could do
hit
that.
Your head.
You could actually have a heart attack or a stroke from low blood pressure.
Oh, really? How do you get that from low blood pressure?
If you don't get any blood flow one way or another, whether it's a block or there's lack of perfusion, they can do it the same way.
So then it's ischemic.
Exactly. That's what we're looking at. So
blood pressure. And it also exercises increases insulin sensitivity. So it's not just about diet and diabetes.
Right. Well, when you say insulin sensitivity, what you mean, for those that might not know that, is that when insulin is working very powerfully, you need less of it. And the problem in diabetes is that the insulin we have doesn't work very well, and so you make more, and that causes problems, or you don't have enough of it. So making it work better, which exercise does, increases the sensitivity of insulin. It works to prevent cancer as well, lots of cancers.
Well, it detoxifies.
It's a great way to detoxify. I don't know a better way to detoxify, actually. You know, they have all these detox programs, but what would be better than
to sweat it out?
You know, when we played years ago hard tennis, I'd lose 5, 6, 7 pounds in a day on a hot day.
I remember one time you lost 16 pounds.
Well, that was over 2 days.
That was a lot of fluid.
Yeah, that was. The conditions were something different there, too. The
hot.
High humidity and the heat, right. So that's a great way to get all those pollutants that store in our fat and wash them out of our body.
It's a good idea after you've exercised like that to not let it sit on your skin. It's good to take a shower right away.
Oh, that's such
a
good point.
Especially if you use a brush, too, and just
yeah,
get
use
off,
a loofah sponge or something like that, because it's fat soluble. You're trying to get it out of your fat, and that's how some of those poisons are expressed from the body.
Yeah, because toxins are stored in our fat.
Exactly.
And a lot of the oil glands and so forth that are when we perspire and when we sweat are secreting that.
Right.
But, you know, if you don't feel like exercising, you know, ask a friend. Do something to get you to do it. You know, join a gym, join a dance class, join a Zumba class, go swimming. Just get up and move. You got to find a way to get up and move. Get a trampoline.
Do anything, but get off the couch. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. And it's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on what doctors are saying about Obamacare. I wonder what they even know about it, because they don't seem to have much of expertise in that. And then we'll be right back with, does wearing gowns and gloves in all ICU patients' rooms reduce the incidence of MRSA?
So what are the doctors saying about Obamacare? Well, the American Medical Association has weighed in on Obama's new health care package, and the allergists were in favor of scratching it.
Oh, here we go.
But the dermatologist advised not to make any rash moves.
Oh, dear.
The gastroenterologist had sort of a gut feeling about it, but the neurologist thought the administration had a lot of nerve. Meanwhile, obstetricians felt certain that everyone was laboring under a misconception.
That's true.
While the ophthalmologist considered the idea short-sighted. Pathologists yelled, "Over my dead body!" While the pediatrician said, "Oh, grow up." The psychiatrist thought the whole idea was madness, while the radiologist could see right through it.
True.
Surgeons decided to wash their hands of the whole thing. The internists claim it would indeed be a bitter pill to swallow, and the plastic surgeons opined that this proposal would put a whole new face on the matter. The podiatrists thought it was a step forward, but the urologists were pissed off at the whole idea. Anesthesiologists thought the whole idea was a gas, and those lofty cardiologists didn't have the heart to say no. In the end, the proctologist won out.
As they usually do.
Leaving the entire decision up to the assholes in Washington.
Oh, that's great, Vicki. It's hard to be too serious about Obamacare because they've got so many problems with it. A small step in the right direction, but overall a few steps backwards.
So hospital-acquired infections are a real concern, particularly with 100,000 deaths a year from them. And they're especially a problem with antibiotic-resistant infections that are so common in the ICU.
Right.
So a study was done showing that ICU healthcare workers who wore disposable gowns and gloves when entering each patient's room also washed their hands more often. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, sure.
When leaving those rooms, and the reduction in the MRSA, that's the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, was notable. So how did they do this study?
It's interesting. They got together with 20 medical and surgical ICUs across 15 states and examined nearly 92,000 cultures from more than 26,000 patients over a nine-month period in the year 2012. So this is a big study. And then they randomized the ICUs into two groups. One group would get the intervention where they would wear the gloves and mask for every patient that was there. And the other group would just follow the CDC's protocols and just wear gloves and a gown in those patients who had an infection or were carriers.
So what are the current CDC guidelines about wearing gowns and gloves when caring for patients?
They're still that way. They haven't changed any.
And just in isolation.
Yeah, just those patients who have the infection or are carrying it. So some people are just carrying methicillin-resistant staph, like in a nasal swab or something like that.
So according to this study, then, should this be universally adopted in the ICUs, or are there other more practical solutions?
No, I think that's what they're saying, and I think it makes a lot of sense anyway. And the thing that was, to me, the most interesting is that the medical staff was actually washing their hands when they got out of the unit. A lot of the time, you know, everybody's in a hurry, and they don't put a gown on, or they don't put gloves on, or they don't wash their hands when they come in or leave the room. And, of course, these are all things that are important because 5% of all hospitalizations, that's 1 in 20 people entering the hospital, is going to have an infection that's going to be a significant infection.
But
that's,
you know,
a big number.
I noticed when you had your hip surgery that they don't wash their hands with soap and water. They use the antimicrobial sanitizer stuff that creates resistant bacteria, really.
Well, it's not a good idea. I mean, we have this kill mentality in medicine. We're going to kill things that are no good. Kill the cancer. Kill the microbe. Kill whatever is the problem.
Well, it was the same thing for giving you a bath. They didn't want you to use soap and water. They just handed you some wipes to do.
They wanted to get rid of all the most powerful bacteria they could, or microbes they could. They didn't understand that by wiping out all the microbes on the skin, that it sets the stage for colonizing what's left or what's resistant to it. But you still have to pay attention to the data. The data shows that if you do what they say, that your risk of getting a staph infection or a vancomycin-resistant enterococcus or something like that goes down. So all of our philosophy, which I think is sound, may not hold up when it comes to the actual test because you have to pay attention to what these studies actually show.
Well, remember that study that was showing the healthcare workers on the video and how often they wash their hands, and they started washing their hands more because they knew
being watched. Nobody wants to be the guy or the person that is not following the rules, and they may try to get away with it if nobody's watching. But when that video camera went up, the numbers went up like from 30 or 40% to 85 or 90% because nobody wanted to have the potential responsibility for having given somebody an infection. And the same thing happens with clothing. The tie that the doctor may wear if they do, or the shirt, or the whatever they've got on that touches anything in the room, is a great way to put that microbe
around.
Yeah, it does for sure.
Well, I think personally that the gloves are a good idea because when I was a nurse, I washed my hands so much that they would crack and they'd
kind
of bleed
good.
Sometimes because I wash them so often.
Well, that's why probably just gentle soap and water is sufficient. And then just dry them off. And that would get rid of 95 or 99% of the microbes that are there. The big thing, I think, is the clothing. And when you're looking at the ICU, where people are, their immunity systems are weak, you got to be careful about spreading germs around because that's one good way to get people infected. And it's why 5% of the people in the hospital have an infection, you know, they didn't have before they came in.
Yeah, well, like you said, their immune system is shot.
Right.
Because they're sick. Well, you know, not too long ago, we talked about copper surfacing and how that would kill 97% of the bacteria, including the MRSA and C. difficile and fungus and viruses
it
like the
flu
and so
forth.
Kills
just about everything.
Maybe they think copper's too expensive, but what about the cost of all these disposable gowns and gloves?
Well, how about the cost of one infection where somebody's in the ICU because of an infection for, you know, 3 months? $100,000, if it costs that much to put copper every place in that room, would be a great idea.
Well, putting it on the doors,
on
the
telephones, on any place, the bed rails.
Yeah.
I mean, anything where people touch, because it really does kill bacteria in just a few minutes. It's an amazingly potent thing that we should be paying attention to.
Okay, also, what about boosting immunity of the people that are in the hospital that are so sick so they won't be so susceptible to getting infections? How would you do that?
Well, the first thing is good nutrition. You want to be sure they're getting all the nutrients they need.
What if they can't eat, too?
Then they can give it IV, or they could use it through a tube, or there are lots of ways of administering it. Intravenous is what a lot of people need to be on, but it shouldn't just be sugar water. It ought to have things in it. It should have the
vitamins
and minerals and nutrients that our body needs. Vitamin D, almost everybody in the hospital is low in vitamin D. And you cannot have good immunity with a low vitamin D.
What about vitamin C?
Vitamin C is important. How about all the B vitamins? I mean, they're all important.
And probiotics, if a person can eat or at least have a gastric tube.
Exactly. And a little L-glutamine, which is an amino acid that prevents all that intestinal tract lining from disappearing. It literally dissolves in 72 hours.
What does?
The intestinal lining does. All those little villi and microvilli in the intestines, they're gone in 3 days if you don't put food in there. If you can put a little L-glutamine either in the IV or by mouth, if they can tolerate that, it prevents that. So really? It's a great
if
way to go.
If you don't eat for 3 days, that happens?
The GI tract turns over faster than any organ system in the body.
So what happens when they start eating again then?
It takes time for them to grow back, and you can't just start eating like crazy because you'll get sick.
So they can't digest the food then?
They can't absorb and digest it. That's right. So those are two big things.
Well, also, I think antibiotics, doctors tend to overdo antibiotics, and that's why we get these antibiotic-resistant infections in the first place.
Well, yes.
What do you think they could do instead of the antibiotics?
Well, in a hospital, that's a tough question, because usually those people are pretty sick, their immune systems are weak, and if there's an infection there, you have to treat it.
Well, what about probiotics? We're always talking about probiotics.
Well, you can add that too, for sure, and the L-glutamine as well. I think those are all important things to do, but I think that when people are in the hospital, their immune systems are just not good. And so you want to do what you can to get them back to be stronger. And the use of antibiotics in that setting, I'm a little bit more liberal on, particularly if they're given intravenously. It's when they're given orally that they have such ravaging effects on the gut, as opposed to when we do it the other way.
Hmm. So what about injections? I remember years ago we used to get antibiotics like in our muscles.
Yeah, no, that's okay too. It's when you have antibiotics in direct contact with the microbes in the gut that it does the most damage, because that's the highest concentration. When you give it intramuscularly or subcutaneously or intravenously, another whole story. There, I think it's tolerated better, but you have to keep in mind that people are in the hospital who have pneumonia, diverticulitis, have a some kind of infection.
They're getting it IV.
Well, they need to get antibiotics or they would die, most of them. That's why the antibiotic era that we have is such an important step forward.
So if they're not taking the antibiotic by mouth, mm-hmm. do they need the probiotics?
It would be good if they could, but not everybody can eat.
But I want to know if the antibiotic isn't going into their gut, if they need the probiotic in their gut for the antibiotic.
Well, yes, but if you feed somebody who can't tolerate something, they're just going to vomit, not absorb it. This food will just sit there. It won't do any good. So a lot of people in the hospital cannot eat. They cannot take anything by mouth. And if they can't, then you must do what you have to combat the infection. And I wouldn't be looking for fancy things that we find in complementary and alternative medicine there. I'm looking at the major players, the big antibiotics.
There's a time and a place for medicine.
Absolutely. And in the hospital, we need to do that. All right. It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. And when we come back, we'll be talking about why do doctors abuse prescription drugs. So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
You know, it's not new that doctor training can be abusive, with the long shifts and the lack of sleep often leading to relationship problems and more. And doctors also have easy access to prescription medications, and mm-hmm. it's tempting to treat themselves rather than to see another doctor regarding a health problem, whether it's physical or emotional. So it's no surprise that doctors can abuse prescription drugs and self-medicate.
Yeah, it's really simple. And if you know, I mean, I often have to admit, I'll treat myself. If I've got something that I want to deal with, rather than go to somebody else who I trust less than I trust myself, I'll make my own decisions about that. And in general, I don't use much in the way of medications, hardly ever.
You have a good friend that's a doctor that's been treating his own self that has cancer for several years.
He's doing a great job. It's amazing how much more he's doing. See, cancer is a very special condition. When you've got cancer, what you need is integrative care. You need the best that there is from mainstream medicine that uses pharmacology and radiation and surgery. But you also want the other options, and you can't get them very often. So he comes to me to try and weave them together, but he's doing great by himself. He doesn't need me. He's researched more than anybody I know and is doing great with a stage 4 colon cancer. I'm so impressed with the work he's doing.
The thing is with people that have pain, though, you know.
Or psychological problems.
And then they start treating themselves with pain pills and narcotics and antidepressants. And
well, it's easy to get addicted to stuff like that. You know, if you've got pain and you hurt, you want to do something. And you do what you have to relieve the pain.
The trouble is that many times people become addicted anyway, but this particular study was about doctors that become addicted. And some of the reasons, are the stress. And suicide, we know in medical students, is 11%.
Yeah, that's, well, not suicide, but suicide thoughts. Suicidal thoughts are. Not 11% of all doctors will commit suicide while in medical school. Well, they might all feel like it sometimes. I know I can remember back then when I was so stressed out because there was so much work to do and there was so little time and we weren't treated with a whole lot of respect. That was a tough time. And that's part of what happens to good people who are wanting to be doctors. They're going in there, I'd say the vast majority of them are, because they really want to help people. They're concerned about people.
But then they get burned out.
Well, they get more than burned out. I mean, they get beat up because they're working hours that are ridiculous. There's no time for them to have for their families that amounts to much. They can't relax. It's hard for them to get away for very long to take more than a short vacation every year.
Well, it sounds kind of like medical students really shouldn't be married. That's kind of...
Well,
it's not a real good idea because if you're never going to be home, and how can you have a good relationship when you're that tired and you're studying and working that hard?
You're right. You can't.
What was yours like?
Oh, it was terrible. I didn't want to go back there and remember it. It was very difficult. And I think that what we should be doing is nurturing these young doctors so that we're supporting them and encouraging them and letting them know they're doing a great thing and reward them for it and listen to them and care about how they feel. That's what medical students need.
So how would you like to have a doctor treating you that's an addict?
Oh,
I mean, their judgment is definitely going to be impaired.
Right.
And we already have enough.
A surgeon.
We already have enough medical errors. I mean, this could be another reason for medical errors.
Well, medicine is complicated. It's very difficult to do well. You have to know too much. And a lot of the time what happens, because there's so much to learn, we divide it up into little pieces. We got the hand doctor and the foot doctor, and we've got the eye doctor and the nose doctor, and we got the chest doctor and the kidney doctor. But what do they know about all those other things we just mentioned? Probably not a whole lot. Certainly something, because in medical school you get a broad kind of training. But after that, it's all narrow and focused. And people aren't pieces. People are one thing. They're a human being. And they've got different perspectives about them that are important to consider, and we should do that. So I'm not surprised that we get into the problems that we do because it's very stressful. And you can expect you're going to make mistakes. You know, when you pass your boards, you may get 3/4 or 80% of the questions right and still pass. But that means you don't know the other 20 or 25%. And it's going to come back and bite you at some time. It has to.
And especially if you're taking medications that can make you feel weird.
Well, that's right.
Mess with your thinking. So they say in this article that the solution is to educate the medical students and the doctors to seek help and not to treat themselves. But
that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I mean,
it makes a little bit of sense because you want to be aware of it. Do you really think they're not aware of it? I mean, the problem is what they're doing to them. We need to stop that. That's a major problem.
So why do you think people want to be doctors if it's so stressful?
Well, they don't anticipate that it's going to be that hard. You know, it all sounds rosy until you get there.
They want to take care of people.
It's like, you know, you join the Navy to see the world through a porthole and on a ship and having to clean it and doing all the things that you do. It's a lot different than the glamour that it's built up to be.
Yeah, a lot of them, I think, like the idea of the authority and the prestige
and the money. Well, those are all things that come into play.
Second home and all that.
Well, it's a system that's not that good, and it's not the whole reason for why doctors take drugs. I mean, people have problems anyway. They get hurt and they get addicted to pain medicine. I mean, everybody who is on narcotics is at risk for that. And who doesn't have emotional issues or psychiatric problems from time to time? You're going to get depressed at some time in your life, and you're probably going to have stresses every day. So that's a problem. But a lot of people want to get away from it. And when they do, what are they looking for? They're looking to get high, to escape from it. to be able to relax and have a good time without thinking too much. So what's better than dulling your mind? I mean, doctors have problems just like everybody else. In this article, they said that the risk for becoming addicted or misuse drugs is the same with doctors as it is in the general public. I don't think that's true. I've seen other studies that show that doctors have a much higher rate of suicide and of addiction to drugs and alcohol and whatever.
I remember years ago when I was working in the hospital, that when I was in ICU, there was a nurse that I worked with, and frequently it was just the two of us. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that she was addicted to drugs. I found out a few years later that she was fired because of it, but I had no clue. I had no idea. It would be so easy to just take them yourselves when they're supposed to be for the patient.
That's what happens. We do the best we can and try to make sure that we're doing okay. Okay, this is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Spitter here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on ingredients to check in your skincare products. And what? How about bird poop? Did you write that one? Holy smoke. What kind of cosmetics? This is avian products. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can probiotics prevent and treat vaginal dryness? And what's in that chicken nuggets you've been eating?
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo, and I'd like to introduce you to drsaputo.com, which is the web's most unique and evolutionary resource for good health and self-empowerment. DrSaputo.com offers a library of more than 2,000 audio and video files featuring me and my wife, registered nurse Vicki Saputo, with cutting-edge integrative and holistic health information. Our media files also include an impressive array of leading health and wellness experts.
Taking the health assessments on DrSaputo.com will provide you with customized integrative information about your unique health issues with specific ideas about how to safely and effectively manage them.
This website offers free membership as a service to inspire and educate, honoring you and your privacy while you're taking responsibility for your health.
DrSaputo.com offers entertaining and informative fast-track videos every weekday morning on what's new in healthcare, so you can cut through the confusion.
Visit DrSaputo.com and take your free health assessment now. That's DrSaputo.com.
To touch on a few skincare ingredients that you may think are okay to use, like mineral oil and collagen and lanolin, that are best to avoid. Now, with mineral oil, I just want to go over it again. I think I've talked about mineral oil before, but it includes things like petroleum jelly and petrolatum, Vaseline, paraffin, so forth. And regardless of the refining of the hydrocarbons, they're not healthy for the body because they block the skin's pores and they interrupt the skin's natural respiration and eliminating functions. In other words, it's kind of like putting saran wrap on yourself. And mineral oils are in all kinds of skincare products and makeups and creams and lipsticks and baby creams and so forth. And some examples would be like Vaseline intensive care hand lotion. In fact, the other day I heard an ad for some sort of Vaseline spray to make it easier so you can spray it all over your body and your back and everything. It's like, oh my goodness, that's not a good idea. And a lot of the sunscreens and the lipsticks and so forth have mineral oil, so stay away from mineral oil. Also, now lanolin. You know, you see lanolin in a lot of products, even in a lot of the ones that are supposed to be natural and healthy. Lanolin is wool fat or wool wax, and this is a product of the oil glands of sheep, and it's often used in lipsticks and mascaras and all kinds of things, eyeshadows and blushes and so forth. But the problem with it is that it's a skin sensitizer, and it can cause allergic skin rashes. Mm. And some of the companies that use it would be like Revlon, and even the Baby Magic Gentle Baby Lotion that has that original baby scent, that has lanolin in it. So probably not a good idea for your baby if you don't want your baby to get a rash, because that's a possibility. Then there's collagen. Now, not that this is such a bad thing. It's a protein substance, and it's found in connective tissue. But in cosmetics, it's often derived from animal tissue, And according to medical experts, it really can't affect the skin's own collagen when it's applied topically, because the molecules, the collagen molecules, are too big to work when they're applied topically, and they really would need to be injected if it was going to be any different. So it's a bit like saying that you're going to cool off a bottle of milk by holding it against the outside of the refrigerator. It's just not going to work. And then lip plumpers are pretty popular right now. Some women want plumper lips or a bee sting look. Well, you can purchase topical products that basically what they're doing is they irritate your lips so that they become inflamed and look so sexy. But, you know, you can get that same effect by pursing your lips together and tapping them, because the lips respond to trauma by getting swollen. Pow. Then I wanted to mention the geisha facial.
Oh, my God.
This geisha facial is made with bird poop.
What?
And Tom Cruise is somebody that's a big fan of this geisha facial, and it uses purified nightingale droppings.
Oh, nice. And purified?
They cover your face with the stuff, and it can cost $200. It's probably not harmful, but there's no proof that this excrement from a particular bird is uniquely beneficial to the skin. So, you know,
We do to look good or to think we look good is amazing.
And then the last thing I just wanted to mention was about exfoliation, because many people think that this is such a great thing to do to get rid of the dead skin, the layers of dead skin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to do once in a while, but you don't want to overdo it, because it can create sensitized, dry, dehydrated skin that's more susceptible to sun damage. So when you do exfoliate, do it gently and do it at night so that it's not just before you go out into the sun.
Mm.
Now, to our show. As women age and they go through menopause, they often lose their interest in sex. There's lots of jokes about this. And it's due to vaginal dryness and atrophy that results in painful intercourse. And as a result, they often use lubricants and moisturizers and hormones to try to correct the problem. And these things may be actually contributing to the problem.
Right.
So we're going to talk about how that can be and about this new study that suggests that it might be from a change in the vaginal flora, because it turns out that our vajayjays may need probiotics.
Yeah, probiotics go everywhere, don't they? But that's because we live in a sea of microbes, and we have a symbiotic relationship with them. They do things for us, and we do things for them. That's how the whole business of the gut works, and all the changes that we see in the intestinal microflora that cause an upset in the relationship it has with our inner body. And so the vagina is no different. So we're looking at a problem here that really reflects that as a woman ages, her relationship with the microbes that she lives with changes as well. That's no surprise, because our biochemistry and physiology change too. So what happened is there was a study that was done, out of Cleveland, the University of Maryland, actually, that showed that there were, with 87 women aged 35 to 60 years old, that there were different kinds of microbes that lived in women of different ages. And it, as a woman aged and went through different stages of her reproductive life, that the mixture became much more deficient in the lactobacillus in the vagina than it was at a time when things were different from the point of view of hormonal concentrations.
So what do we do? Apply yogurt?
Well, that's what Jamie Lee.
I can see her now.
Yeah, well, you could. I mean, that would be one thing you could do that might help a little, but the concentration of lactobacilli in there is not that much. I think that there are vaginal probiotics that are possible, that are available, that can be used, and actually doctors are using them in women who have infections that sometimes can't be treated in other ways. And I think that because this is such an easy thing to do and such a safe thing to do, that it probably should be done for almost any kind of infection, particularly yeast infections.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that many times women that have gone through menopause use hormones.
Right. Well, that works, too.
In the area.
Well, it changes the environment. It changes the
biochemistry. But also, this study says that those hormones can actually change the flora in a negative way.
Well, they could, but in general, you'd like to be the way nature made things happen, as long as things haven't gone wrong. We disturb the ecosystems in the different parts of our body when we take antibiotics or we're under stress or we use products for lubrication or for trying to moisturize that have an effect on the microbes that live there. So it changes
maybe it
the ecosystem.
Maybe it depends on the type of lubricant.
Well, it would, depending on what's in it. I mean, is anything really inert? Probably there are some inert things, but and they are what you want.
Well, especially like we're talking about skincare products. I mean, there's probably some that have a lot of iffy ingredients in them.
Oh, no question.
And then it's the same thing with douches. I mean, probably no douche is better, except for just maybe every once in a while. And then there's all these douches out there that have flavors and artificial colors and fragrances and all that kind
of thing.
Well,
that's not the way it was meant to be. That's right. So we start changing it around because of our personal preferences. And what happens is we start disturbing the normal physiology and the relationship between the microflora and the host.
Well, the other thing we know, the other reasons are antibiotics.
For sure. I mean, when people take antibiotics, what's the first thing they get?
A yeast infection.
So what would happen if we use Saccharomyces boulardii and some lactobacilli in a product that could be used as a probiotic that's a vaginal probiotic? It probably would protect it if you started first. Because you know the yeast are going to overgrow, but if you put in a friendly yeast, like the Saccharomyces yeast, it's not going to cause any symptoms, but it will crowd out the candida, which will cause symptoms.
So it's a probiotic, but
it's a probiotic.
Yeast probiotic.
Yeah, that's right. So there are lots of ways to do this, and I guess the bottom line here is as we age, the microflora changes, and as the microflora changes, it has an effect on how healthy we are and what we can do.
Well, I think it's good for women to hear this and to learn about this.
Well, exactly.
And to be thinking about what they use.
Well, yeah, we don't want to go in there with a sledgehammer to kill an ant. And that's what I think using hormones is what happens most of the time, even though there's a big move that way. All right, so
when you take your kids out to dinner,
right?
What do you order? Do you go to a fast food restaurant? Ever ordered chicken nuggets?
Right.
Sounds like chicken. High protein, white chicken meat, right?
Right. Right.
Wrong.
Oh, dear.
Mississippi researchers found that the ingredients in this yummy-tasting finger food are more like eating a chicken hot dog made up of chicken scraps, preservatives,
really true.
Trans fats, sugar, salt, and GMO corn. You know, it made me actually do a Google search on fish sticks to see what are in those, because people give those to their kids, too, and those are pressed fish with binding ingredients. So, I don't know. Is this food? Or artificial food that's deep fried, breaded, or in batter with additives and preservatives.
Well, it's a way to make money. I think that's a better way to say it. It's a food product. It's certainly not food. And when they did this particular study that was published in the American Journal of Medicine in October of 2013, I mean, that was a huge thing to tell people about. And what they found when they analyzed this, you know, they looked at these chicken nuggets by preserving them and then dissecting them and staining them and then looked at them under the microscope. And what they found, that they only looked at two nuggets, so it wasn't like they did a huge study. But it was enough to get into this prestigious
journal.
Yeah,
I did a Google on chicken McNuggets.
Yeah, I did too.
And it had a lot of all these things in it that I was just talking about.
It didn't look so good. But what they found in the first nugget was about 50% was muscle. That's good because it's the chicken tissue. But then it was a mixture of fat, blood vessels, and nerves and cells that come from the skin and internal organs. Not
a lot of people eat chicken skin, though.
They do. Okay. That's right. They do.
So that part's not so bad. But
what did you find when you looked at under chicken McNuggets?
All the scraps, like I said.
It's like a hot dog.
Yeah, it was like a hot dog. All this and organs and, I don't know, all the different bone, cartilage, fat.
That's right.
There's 56% of it is GMO corn.
Oh, my gosh.
And there's 38 ingredients in it.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's sort of like, why not just make some chicken?
Yeah.
And if you want to deep fry it, I mean, that's somebody's choice if they want to eat deep fried
chicken. Use coconut
chicken.
Oil or a healthy olive oil.
Yeah, that would be really good to
it
do that.
Good. Right.
And then it wouldn't be so bad. But I guess because it's so cheap to do this, because this is the part of the chicken that they would be throwing away.
Grind it all up. Make it like a hamburger.
Squish it together.
Right, but a hamburger.
And deep fry it with batter or breaded it or whatever.
Exactly.
What you're eating is the part that they normally throw away.
Only good thing I saw that I really liked in the Chicken McNugget is the fact they use sea salt. That really surprised me.
Uh-huh. Well, you were asking me about some of the other ingredients.
Oh, yes.
Toxic synthetic chemicals. Mm-hmm. They have anti-foaming agents so that the oil doesn't foam up so much. They have anti-rancid stuff in there, petroleum-derived preservatives, and I already said the GMO corn, and anti-flammables and carcinogenic chemicals and lighter fluid. They've got butane in there.
Oh, my God. That's right. It's not gluten-free.
And this is what you're feeding to your kids.
Yeah.
Or yourself.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, they taste good.
They taste good. See,
right.
That's the problem. That's where they get you.
Sure. It's a place to go where there's social value to it, too, because the kids all want the prize they're going to get, or they want the soft drink or the other stuff that's not good for you as well that you see at a lot of these places.
So talk about this TBHQ, this preservative that's in there.
Well, that's another one. It's a good antioxidant, okay, and it's used as a preservative to help keep unsaturated vegetable oils from biodegrading and becoming toxic. But it's also used for some interesting things. Like, for example, it's used industrially as a stabilizer. It prevents corrosion in biodiesel. It's used in perfumes, varnishes, lacquers, resins, and oil field additives. I mean, there are a lot of things. And it's probably carcinogenic. You have to worry about getting stomach cancer, and it damages DNA if you give enough of it. So we're really taking some risks when we do that. You have to keep in mind that the point of what is happening with the chicken industry itself is that they want to make money. And so they're doing what they can to try and lower the cost of the product and to keep the price as high as it can so they can get kids to like it because it tastes good, or adults to like it for that matter, everybody's going to buy it.
Well, you know, just like I was mentioning, comparing it to a hot dog, The other day I was in San Francisco. In fact, I even took a photograph of it. There was a hot dog stand on the street at Union Square.
Mm-hmm.
And it said on the front of it that the hot dogs were made with grass-fed organic beef.
Wow, that's a start.
And I thought, well, isn't that something?
Isn't that smart?
It's smart, but that people are paying much more attention to this kind of thing. Then as I walked further and I went down Powell Street on the right-hand side, someplace past, I don't know, Coletto's, someplace down there, I saw a hamburger joint.
Uh-huh.
And this hamburger joint said the same thing, that they had organic grass-fed beef. But isn't that a big step? We're coming a long way. That's because the people are demanding it.
Well, the street vendors are.
And people are voting with their pockets.
That's right. Well, there's been a big change in the last 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, even doctors are starting to learn something about nutrition.
But just because it's organic doesn't mean that it's always going to be healthy either, you know. But it's a big step. Because they probably use scraps with the hot dogs, you know, things that you might
want. Well, they want to use everything they possibly can, and that's what they do.
Because people have always joked that a hot dog is made from sweeping the butcher shop floor, you know.
Well, don't laugh.
Sawdust and
well, I don't think we go that far. At least I hope we don't go that far. Now, there were some people who thought this was really a good idea, Vicki. They just really said, this is fine for America. Can't guess who they were.
Eat Chicken McNuggets?
Yeah.
Who?
The National Chicken Council.
Oh, right.
They went and said, well, your sample size is too small. There was just two nuggets. And, of course, that's true.
Yeah, but see, we did some more research that we're reporting to you after we looked up the ingredients.
Well, you have to. And when you see all the things that are in it, you start to go, what's going on here?
But, you know, if you're really disappointed and you love chicken nuggets and you want to give them to your kids or whatever, if
make
you do a
own.
Google search, they had some great recipes for making your own. And we would recommend, if you're going to fry anything, to use coconut oil, because that's probably the healthiest.
Well, if you're going to deep fry something, I mean, that's the way to do it, because it's a saturated fat that's healthy for you, that your body tolerates and actually makes it is good. When you use unsaturated vegetable oils, the polyunsaturated oils, they aren't heat stable, and what happens is they make a real mess. And also in here were a lot of...
A mess in your body, you mean.
Yes. They also had polyunsaturated trans fats in them as well. So there are a lot of bad things about that. Well, we're out of time, so we want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.